Your name, please?
I'm Ben Bagdikian.
And your occupation and position?
I'm a writer and a contributing writer to the Saturday Evening Post.
Mr. Bagdikian, it's been said that the poor we have always with us. Does this necessarily have to be so?
My viewpoint, Father, is that the poor will always be with us only in the sense that there will always be some who have less than others, but that it is unethical and calloused for us to assume that because this is so, we have no responsibility for those who are less fortunate than we are.
This is Viewpoint, an unrehearsed and personal interview with another distinguished and well-known personality who will reveal to you, the American public, what he holds to be the responsibilities of his position in American life, produced by the Episcopal Church and brought to you as a public service by this station. Mr. Kennedy's guest today is Ben H. Bagdikian, award-winning newspaper reporter, a contributing writer for the Saturday Evening Post, and author of the current book, In the Midst of Plenty. Here is the moderator of the award-winning series, Viewpoint, the Reverend Dana F. Kennedy. Mr. Kennedy.
Welcome to Viewpoint, Mr. Ben Bagdikian. Are poor people poor because they don't work as hard as the people who have more?
I'm sure that this is true of some cases, but I'm also sure it's not true of most. I've spent an interesting time recently in Southern Virginia in a place where there were no public schools for 4 years. And when they tested these children, half of them had IQs of less than 78. Now, this is a person who is almost useless in our society. They simply hadn't had any education. They came in and were asked to put their names, these would be 10-year-old children, in the upper right-hand corner of paper. They didn't know what upper meant, they didn't know what right hand meant, they didn't know what corner meant, and some of them didn't know how to use a pencil. So if you let these children go the way they are, they're going to be apathetic in a city life, they're going to be failures, they certainly aren't going to try to get a job involving paper and pencil and following instructions, and yet this is the kind of job we have today. Is that person poor because he's lazy or he doesn't try, or is he poor because he simply has not gained the kind of civilization by which we survive today? It was demonstrated there that if you give this person a good education, this changes radically. This becomes the average person who seemed to be mentally retarded before becomes a useful, bright, eager citizen. So certainly some of the poor are poor because they're psychologically crippled or they are poorly motivated for maybe organic reasons. We don't know.
Is it poor economy to have poor people in the country?
Oh, of course, because poverty makes for poverty. I think poverty doesn't pay. You know, it's bad business to have poor people. I don't think this is a good justification for attacking poverty, and I think it's wrong that we so often use this. I think we ought to attack it because this is a miserable human condition and we ought to feel some responsibility for it.
Why?
But it happens to be self-interest, too.
Why should we feel a responsibility for somebody who's poor and perhaps live 2,000 miles away from us?
Well, because they're fellow human beings, and I think morally this puts an obligation on us that if we know of the suffering of somebody and we have it within our power to help, we are then morally obligated to do it.
Is the help which you suggest for the poor, giving them clothes, giving them food, giving them medical supplies, is this the kind of help, or what is it that the poor really need?
Well, they need these things, of course. You know, in a lot of rural schools, the attendance drops in December, January, February. Why? Because they don't have warm clothes to go to school in. A child who hasn't eaten properly falls asleep in class, or he's listless. He needs food. He needs clothing. But we need something else. These are the physical necessities in order to clothe the body, in order to provide energy. But this isn't the basic reason for poverty. The basic reason for poverty is that these people are alienated from their own culture. They don't have the social experience, which means in being involved in normal American life. Now, this means establishing a bridge between them and between normal American society. This means human beings. This means going into the slums, going into the rural areas, not with a sense of noblesse oblige and coming and telling them, we will show you how nice middle-class life is. They don't really, at this point, care much about middle-class life, nor should they. Aside from the physical aid to the poor, which is necessary, the most important link is the human link, which establishes a bridge between this isolation of poverty and the rest of American life.
How does society go about establishing these human links?
We are beginning to see that there are real human beings that need very specific kinds of help, which we hadn't, you know, we had been thinking of all these people as living in the picturesque shanties of the Negroes of the South, kind of cardboard figures who liked it the way they were. The poor were always going to be with us, and this was sort of a stable part of our society. We find it isn't stable. We find that these people, if we look closely, are much more like ourselves than we'd like to think, and that they can be helped, and our whole society can be. We're going to find things about our own society that will prevent poverty in the years to come, because a very deep cause of modern poverty is the advancement of technology and the machine. And we who have middle-class jobs, people who work in banks and insurance companies, have a false security that automation is going to hit the factory worker, but not us. But beware, it is the middle-class worker who is going to be hit. It's the banks who are doing their work by calculating machines. We are going to learn something about, number one, getting some idea of where our society is going technologically, and number two, how best we can design our society so that the maximum number of citizens will have the maximum opportunity if they want it. The people who are now poor, in a way, are the victims of past change. But I think we're going to learn from them how to handle the inevitable continuing victims of future change.
How large a proportion of our population is considered poor?
Well, I think about 36 million, which is about 20%. And I used as a basis a family who lives on less than $3,000 a year or an individual who lives on less than $1,000.
Are there any particular groups within our society that have a rather large proportion of this percentage that are poor?
Yes. For example, migrant agricultural workers, about 2 or 3 million of those. These are just incredibly wretched living conditions and people who grow up in chaotic lives. The small farmers, you know, he's the kind of the hero image of American society, but unfortunately he's obsolete and he's starving. About the toughest way, the thing to be in the United States is a Negro who hasn't gone past the eighth grade and grew up in a rural area, because the poor typically have less than an eighth grade education. If you're a Negro, you have double the chance of being poorer than if you're white. Also, the lack of a working head of a household will produce not only poverty at the moment, but instability and poverty in the children. So there are analyses of the poor, and the common characteristic is that they are less trained, less educated in the ways of modern work. But of course, Negroes are just about 22% of the poor. Most of them are white.
How about the American Indian? Are they considered among the poor?
They are almost by definition poor. They are also very proud. Many of them don't consider themselves poor, and this is an asset, except that they see that somehow their children die earlier, their children are leaving the reservations to get work and not very successfully. They want education, and they aren't sure how this fits into the old tribal family system, and at the same time, working at modern jobs. So that there are about 500,000 Indians who are very poor, but who live in a strong culture, which many of them still believe in very strongly. And one of the tragic problems is, how do you maintain this culture, which has many very admirable things about it, at the same time involve these people in modern work, which is necessary for them to live with a standard of living and achievement which we've come to expect as normal.
Mr. Bagdigian, do I gather from what you've said that you view poverty as not only a present problem but a future problem unless we start dealing with it now?
I'm sure of it. You can talk to several levels of people who know about this thing. You could talk, for example, to the men who manufacture automatic machinery. They have been warning for years that we are about to have a large convulsion in our society, and we had better start studying what we're going to do with our people to make these machines useful for us rather than burdens to us.
Are you concerned that the future is going to be rather bad, or do you think there's going to be a hopeful aspect? Are people going to be better when these 12-year-olds grow to adulthood, or are they going to be in a worse situation?
I think we're going to be better because I refuse to believe that this is the kind of a country that will turn its back on this kind of problem. And I think that when we face it, this is going to solve a lot of our other problems too.
Do you think that people in this new age will have more of an understanding of their place in the world before God?
Well, I think that the picture each of us has of his role in life is going to depend a great deal on how we come out of this struggle. I think if we make the terrible and tragic mistake of turning our backs on the dispossessed and the disenfranchised and the disengaged, rejected part of our society, we will withdraw within ourselves. We will respond with the way guilty people have always responded, which is not to be able to face themselves or their fellows, and it will be very unpleasant. On the other hand, as I said, I have faith that this will not happen, that what we are now doing is going through the painful but necessary process of recognizing all others as one with us, and that we cannot really ignore the person that we know about suffering, that we identify with them. Sometimes it's fashionable to sneer at this as do-goodism and hand-wringing, but I'm prejudiced in favor of doing good rather than doing bad, and I think this is a healthy and, in a way, peculiarly American reaction. And I think that we are going to come out with a greater sense of human achievement and human identity and in a devotion to those things which are really important in our ultimate picture of the human role on Earth.
What are the satisfactions, Mr. Bagdean, that you get from your work?
Well, people. I think that if I had to select the one thing which excites me perpetually, from the time I became a newspaper reporter more years ago than I like to think, it is that in all places, and some very unlikely places indeed, there are people whom I discover much like myself, regardless of how we began looking at each other, and some of us have looked at each other with a good deal of hostility, that wherever you go, whatever the color of people's skin, whatever their pay, whatever the kind of countryside or housing they live in, and whatever their original emotions about you, that if you spend enough time, if you aren't just sentimental, and if you don't insist on having a romantic view of everything, but peel off the layers, and there's a man like yourself, and probably a good deal better.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ben Bagdikian, for being with us and for giving us your viewpoint.
This has been Viewpoint, an unrehearsed personal interview with another distinguished and well-known personality, produced as a public service by the Division of Radio and Television of the Episcopal Church. Today's guest was Ben H. Bagdikian, award-winning newspaper reporter, a contributing writer for the Saturday Evening Post, and author of the current book, In the Midst of Plenty.